Hello, and welcome to Essentials for Providers, Part 2. In this section, we're going to discuss documentation challenges and what you can do to prepare, as well as beginning to learn some of the key foundations of ICD-10-CM so that you understand how the codes should be utilized, as well as key rules. There's no doubt that ICD-10 is going to pose some unique challenges to us. In addition to the business rules that I talked about in the first section, we're increasing with our codes to over 69,000. However, it's not the volume of the codes that should be the issue. Rather, it's the specificity that's found within the code sets themselves. So it's important to understand we shouldn't be scared of the number of codes that we're going to, and I'll show you where in the next series, R3, where we can actually start to narrow down some of those numbers. But the level of specificity increases with ICD-10 and the granularity, and that's important for us to understand as we're moving forward to the new code set. ICD-10 is actually going to allow for meaningful use of data as long as the codes are used correctly. It's going to set the stages for some things that we already have in play and some things to come, such as our quality measures or reportings, whether it's PQRS or other health plan incentives, fraud and abuse through health plans, and clinical trials. So it allows us to actually take the data and the clinical information of the patient and put it into those numbers that helps set the stage for the meaningful use or the exchange of meaningful data. There's no doubt that the clinical area faces the largest of the challenges with ICD-10 implementation. We have to make sure that our encounters are coded to the highest level of specificity. That way we can get that good data out that allows for that meaningful exchange. Damage will be done to your practice long term if not coded accurately. We already see out there in the marketplace where health plans are starting to promulgate rules that say under ICD-10-CM, they're not going to accept unspecified codes, or some have taken the approach where maybe you'll be paid less for the continued use of unspecified codes. You want to make sure that you protect your revenue streams by not latching on to unspecified codes under ICD-10. There are certain instances where you're going to have to use them, there's no doubt, but ongoing, you want to make sure that you don't latch on to unspecified codes. Now, I can tell you that example that I use quite often when I'm out teaching and working with physicians is hyperlipidemia. And we have the concept under ICD-9, but we do the same thing and we want to make sure that we break the cycle under ICD-10-CM. So we latch on to that hyperlipidemia unspecified when even after we've treated the patient for 2 years, we have multiple blood works, we know exactly we're treating them with medication, we know what type of hyperlipidemia they have. When we find out what type of hyperlipidemia or the cause of the patient's clinical condition, we need to make sure that we transition away from the use of those unspecified codes. Correct coding will actually allow you to completely spell out the clinical condition of the patient. We've seen a lot of talk where we talk about the external cause codes under ICD-10, and the joke is there's a code for that. It's true. And sometimes we become overwhelmed by all of those concepts. But what I like to point out is if you can spell out to a payer exactly who, what, when, where, and why, you're going to be able to get immediate adjudication without having to submit additional attachments to show where and what happened. We can actually do it through the use of codes now. It kind of alleviates the administrative burden of all of those attachments and that extra documentation. Plus, your claims stand less of a chance to go into subrogation if you can spell out right in the initial claim that happened while the patient was at work or at home, or they were at a volunteer status, those types of things. So it's actually going to help you ensure that revenue neutrality. Now, revenue neutrality is a word that we use a lot out with ICD-10, and it's something that's been a big topic of discussion. And basically, what it comes down to is we want to make sure on the provider side that we still continue to get paid the same as we did under ICD-9. We don't want to have to have any risks where, like, we latch onto the unspecified codes and we might take a hit on future on our revenue for a health plan, that means that they want to make sure that they don't pay more per covered life under ICD-10 than they did under ICD-9. So the correct use of the codes is really going to come into play so that revenue neutrality can be established. It's going to be really important historically for costs not to rise in healthcare due to the new code set. So we have to make sure that we code to the highest level of specificity so that we don't put our practice at risk for revenue decreases. So you want to make sure that you begin working early on with your providers on their current documentation. You can do this through documentation readiness assessments. Now, I can tell you that we've done thousands and thousands of ICD-10 readiness assessments for providers, and overwhelmingly, about 65% of the time, there is not enough information found within the records to support an ICD-10 CM code. So keep in mind, it's not that we think providers are historically poor documenters, but there's more concepts found within ICD-10-CM. And so we need to work with our providers on those newer concepts. So quite simply, doing a documentation readiness assessment is fairly simple. What you're going to want to do is run a practice management report of your most frequently used diagnosis codes. Then you're going to pull and correlate with that all the charts. Some charts that will relate to those diagnosis codes. And basically, you just want to take it and do it like you would do a regular audit, only you're going to look at documentation as it pertains to the diagnosis code. You're not going to do CPT or HCPCS. And you're just going to look to see if there's enough information to pull out an ICD-10 CM code. So you're going to continue to do this as you work down through maybe your most frequently used top 10 codes. Then you're going to keep moving on. Now, it's important that you do this step. You don't want to miss it no matter what you do with your ICD-10 implementation. You really want to make sure that you start to review your physician's documentation, because remember, there's new concepts found within ICD-10-CM that they need to be familiar with, and they need to make sure that they capture in the clinical documentation. Here's an example of how critical it is to work with providers on their documentation. And I have to tell you, I started out using this example as a way to show coders how they needed to increase their level of education with anatomy and pathophysiology, and especially for this, for the disease processes, so that they would have a good understanding of how the ICD-10 codes need to be applied. So in ICD-10-CM, this is actually pretty decent documentation, and we could very easily assign an ICD-9 CM code for it. So we have a 64-year-old male here last week, 3 weeks ago, for wheezing and cough. The MDI and the prednisone work great while on the meds. The first week he was great. He was sleeping through the night. He says he's better, but not like he felt when he was on the prednisone. He feels the prednisone is the only thing making him feel better over the last several weeks. The patient was a former smoker. Now, that's highlighted because that's actually a new concept or a key concept under ICD-10-CM that I'll point out to you on the next slide. The exam was documented. Under the assessment and plan, we have asthma, refills given on meds, and patient educated on triggers. Patient's supposed to come back after the PFT that the physician is ordering, and we gave him his Singulair and his inhalers. So, pretty decent documentation under ICD-9-CM. However, under ICD-10-CM, the only code that we could assign to this patient encounter based on the documentation on that last slide is J45.909 for the unspecified asthma, uncomplicated. There's a new concept under ICD-10-CM for asthma coding, and I'll show you on the next slide where that you really need to start looking and breaking down all of the key elements. In addition, you remember how where I had on the previous slide highlighted that the patient was a former smoker? So in ICD-10-CM, our respiratory codes and some of our sinus codes have an instructional note that says we need an additional code to identify any exposure to environmental tobacco smoke, exposure to tobacco smoke in the perinatal period, history of tobacco use, which is what our patient experienced, which would be Z87.891, occupational exposure to environmental tobacco smoke, tobacco dependence, and tobacco use. So when you take a look at this slide, you can now begin to understand all the expansions of asthma. So you can see where we have J45.21 for mild intermittent asthma with acute exacerbation, or even J45.20, mild intermittent asthma uncomplicated. And then you can see where we go from mild intermittent to mild persistent asthma, J45.31. Or how about J45.40 for the moderate persistent asthma uncomplicated? You can also see that there's caveats for acute exacerbation as well as status asthmaticus. In addition, we have code J45.990 for exercise-induced bronchospasm, as well as J45.991, cough variant asthma, and J45.998 for other asthma. Now, I told you previously, I started to use this example for coders to kind of show them where they need to beef up on their anatomy and pathophysiology. However, what I found out when I was going out and working with clinicians is that for the most part, a lot of them didn't understand the difference between mild persistent or moderate persistent, or where the breakdown should be. So it was interesting to me that now we have this kind of unified thing that we really need to work with our providers to make sure that they capture all of the elements. Now, keep in mind, clinicians document for the patient experience, not for the code set. So coders need to help interpret and work with their providers to make sure that they have the most up-to-date information in the correct codes. Now, this is a chart that I got from the National Heart and Lung Institute, Blood Institute, and you can get them for pretty much from any specialty society that's out there. But basically, it breaks down between intermittent, mild persistent, and moderate persistent, as well as severe persistent asthma. If you can take a chart like this and work with your providers on saying, okay, every time that we have a patient present with asthma, I need you to document how often they're having symptoms, how many times are they awakening at night? How often are they having to use their rescue inhaler? Are they having any interference with normal activity? And what's their lung function? So you can see that if a patient had mild persistent asthma, we would expect the documentation to say that they experience symptoms more than 2 days per week and that they awaken at night 3 to 4 times a month. They have to use their rescue inhaler more than 2 days a week, but not daily. And they are suffering from some minor limitations in their normal activities. Maybe they get winded when they're walking upstairs. And that their lung function is FEV1 greater than 80% predicted. So you can then begin to work with them. This is great to build in with templates on electronic medical records, or even if they're using dictated documentation. For providers that are still in the paper world, we need to make sure that we prompt them to continue to document if they're not documenting now, all of those key elements so that the correct codes can actually be assigned under ICD-10-CM. So based off of that example, and keep in mind that's just one example, we do understand that providers are going to need to be educated on the codes in order to document the required components. They don't need a full-blown code set training, but they need to be familiar with the codes as they pertain to their practice so that they make sure that they document all of the required components. And coders are going to need to have a full understanding of anatomy and pathophysiology in order to understand the clinician's documentation and be able to assign the correct codes to the highest level of specificity. So again, I talked about the importance of documentation evaluations. So run a report by ICD-9 codes for each provider, as they're going to have different top used diagnoses. Then look at those top diagnoses used and compare them to ICD-10-CM and how much they will or won't change. Then take the top diagnosis and run a new report for patients on which that code was entered. Once you do that, then go and pull charts from those lists. That way, you're looking at one diagnosis and one set of guidelines at a time. It'll make it easier for the provider to digest if you stick to one thing at a time as much as possible. So go through about 10 to 15 charts so that you can see the diagnoses and see if you can assign ICD-10 code. If you can, take it further and look. Was it an unspecified code when there were dozens or hundreds of other choices? So you're going to make a report and sit down with your provider and discuss that diagnosis and how it's going to change under ICD-10-CM and show examples from the evaluation that you performed. If the percentage rate isn't acceptable, then you must continue to evaluate that diagnosis until the provider reaches an acceptable percentage. Then you can move on to the next diagnosis and start all over again. So, as you can see, if you have many providers over many specialties, this can become a large task. If needed, look to outsource for help, but don't skip this step. We know that there's a lot of things that are similar in ICD-10-CM as it was in ICD-9-CM, but there are multiple changes in store. You'll see where there's addition of an information that's relevant to ambulatory and managed care encounters. You'll see where the entry codes have expanded and the actual lookup process is slightly different under ICD-10-CM. ICD-10-CM also has created a number of combination codes where you'll find mostly in your endocrine or your diabetes coding or your eye conditions and those types of things. There are tons of combination codes out there in ICD-10-CM that we need to be familiar with. We also need to be familiar with the alphanumeric concept. This can actually slow you down when you're doing code lookup or actually data entry for codes. If you're used to using the numeric keypad on your computer for the entering of codes, it's going to slow you down because you're going to have to two-hand it for a while you put in the alpha characters. Remember that ICD-10 doesn't just start with a letter. There's letters that can be intermixed with the code as well. So you'll see some of those key changes as we're working through the code set. There are 21 chapters in ICD-10-CM. We've added separate chapters for eye and adenexa in the ear. And then the chapters are subdivided into blocks of three character categories. These are called rubrics, and I'll give you the definition of that as we start in further in this presentation. So for coders, I always just say that ICD-10-CM is just a little bit different. We're still going to look things up in the alphabetic index and still verify in the tabular. The process is the same. There's just more of it. So you're going to see similar guidelines. You're going to see the code lookup process really hasn't changed for you. You're still going to see a neoplasm table. However, the neoplasm table has laterality built into it and has a higher level of specificity than what you'll find in ICD-10-CM. In ICD-10-CM, for the malignant neoplasm of the colon and large and small intestine, there's like 26 different locations based just on the site of the neoplasm. So the specificity in the neoplasm table really expands under ICD-10-CM. You won't find a hypertension table. Hypertension coding was actually simplified in ICD-10-CM to actually take that level of detail out of the coding for hypertension. But you'll see a lot of the similarities. So just remember that, you know, it's going to take us a little bit longer in the beginning because we'll see some of that substance in ICD-10-CM that wasn't under ICD-9. So until we get used to working in the code set, you will see some of the differences that slow us down. So let's talk about some of the key changes in ICD-10-CM from ICD-9. The chapters have been rearranged, which kind of makes sense. We're expanding on them. Titles have been changed for the chapters, and actually under ICD-10-CM, these are really long chapter names that you'll see. Conditions have been regrouped to logically fit in where they need to belong. Remember under ICD-9, where sometimes it seemed things were kind of a little haphazard in where we were putting them, and that's basically because we were running out of codes. The conditions have actually been regrouped logically under ICD-10-CM. Since we're transitioning to about 69,000 codes, it's easy to understand that there's almost twice as many categories, as well as some minor changes in the coding rules for mortality. So you'll begin to see where some of the key changes are. There's some key terms that we need to understand under ICD-10-CM so that we can begin to work in it. The first thing that I want you to understand is the use of a combination code. A combination code represents a single code used to classify two diagnoses. So a diagnosis with an associated sign or symptom, a diagnosis with an associated complication, This actually helps simplify the number of codes that are needed to clinically spell out a condition. However, we've got to make sure that we have documentation that's supportive of these combination codes. Some quick examples of combination codes under ICD-10-CM would be Crohn's disease of the large intestine with hemorrhage, or diabetes mellitus type 2 with diabetic retinopathy, or with or without macular edema. So you'll see some of those concepts where these combination codes actually capture the entire clinical condition of that patient for that process. You hear the word granularity used often with ICD-10-CM. That really just refers to the level of specificity or the hierarchy, the amount of information that's found in the diagnostic description of ICD-10-CM. And you'll actually see in detail when we get into the next presentation of how long the code descriptors are and how those will actually come into play with challenges that we're going to have, as well as the information that you can garnish just from the diagnostic description. Laterality is a key concept under ICD-10-CM. For codes or conditions that can be affected bilaterally, either on the right side or the left side, there are code descriptors that include designations for the left, right, and in many cases, bilateral sides as well. Our documentation should always include laterality. So, the key concept here is that you'll find where usually the right side is 1, the left side is 2, bilateral is 3, and then the unspecified side is either 0 or 9, depending on whether it's the 5th or 6th character. Now, when I talk about unspecified codes, the one thing that I have to stress is you should never use an unspecified code when it comes to laterality. You should always be able to tell whoever you're submitting the claim to, that the condition was affected on either the right or the left side. So this is one of those instances where we can start to narrow down those codes. So if a condition includes laterality, you're automatically going to see 3 times as many codes, 1 for the right side, 1 for the left side, and unspecified. 4th, if there's a bilateral option. So you want to keep that in mind when you're working down through all of that. So here's one where I can tell you can narrow down, especially when you're working with your providers. Don't give them the choice of unspecified. Make sure that they understand the laterality concept and that they capture that in their documentation. Now, here's an example of laterality under ICD-10-CM. So you can see where we have H61.12 for the subcategory of hematoma of the pinna. And you can see where we have H61.121 for hematoma of the pinna of the right ear, H61.122 for hematoma of the pinna of the left ear, and H61.123 for hematoma of the pinna bilateral ears. And then, of course, what we would want to rule out or not work with our providers on is the H61.129 hematoma of the pinna unspecified ear. We should never use H61.129 on a claim. Clinical documentation should indicate that the hematoma of the pinna was either the right or the left ear, or that it actually affected both ears. We hear a lot of talk about the principal or the first listed diagnosis code. We use a lot of different terms depending on where you work at or the facility or the practice that you work at. Basically, your principal or your first listed diagnosis code is that code that's sequenced first on the medical record, usually the driving reason for the clinical encounter. What brought the patient in to seek healthcare? That should be your principal or your first listed diagnosis code. The only time that should waver is when there's an instructional note in ICD-10-CM that says to code first, and that leads you to use a different code first and sequence that other code secondly. So your principal or first listed diagnosis code is that code that's sequenced first on the medical record. I used the term rubric earlier in this presentation, and basically a rubric is a group of similar conditions that are denoted by either a 3-character category or a 4-character subcategory in ICD-10-CM. Now, I told you that under ICD-10-CM, there's 21 chapters. Through the World Health Organization, who is responsible for ICD-10. And remember, each country makes their own clinical modifications. In the United States, that's where our CM comes from for the clinical modifications. But from the World Health Organization, or WHO, there's actually 22 chapters. We only use 21 in the United States. We do not use the chapter that begins with the letter U. These codes cannot be compared internationally for their data, and they're temporary in use, so we chose not to use them in ICD-10-CM. Instead, we use the rest of the codes that are found within the other 21 chapters. So, we use all letters of the alphabet with ICD-10-CM for beginning characters, but we don't use the letter U, so you will never see a code that begins with the letter U in ICD-10-CM. So once we get through those three character categories, then we can get into some four character subcategories that further define the site, the etiology, the manifestation, or the state or the disease of the condition. Now, this is where you're going to start to see that level of specificity begin to increase under ICD-10-CM. So you can see here where we have our three character category, the C15 for the malignant neoplasm of the esophagus. And then you're going to see where we're going to break it down. So we have C15.3 for the malignant neoplasm of the upper third of the esophagus, C15.4 for the malignant neoplasm of the middle third of the esophagus, C15.5 for the malignant neoplasm of the lower third of the esophagus, C15.8 for the malignant neoplasm of overlapping sites of the esophagus. So you can see where that fourth character begins to give us that level of specificity where we're getting down to the site. And so that starts to give us more of our structure and our foundation of the codes. When we get down to the fifth and sixth characters in ICD-10-CM, that's what's going to identify our most precise level of specificity. So you can see from our example here that we have S55.011 with the hyphen, and I'll explain that hyphen here in a second. For laceration of the ulnar artery at the forearm level, right arm. The reason that we have that hyphen is because that's an incomplete code. Now in ICD-9-CM we could use the letter X to indicate an incomplete code. However, we can't use that concept in ICD-10-CM because of a dummy placeholder, and I'll explain that here in two slides. But this is an incomplete code because I need a seventh character extender. And that seventh character extender would fall obviously at that seventh character. So say this was the initial encounter, we would see code S55.011A for the laceration of the ulnar artery at the forearm level, right arm, initial encounter. So not every code under ICD-10 requires a seventh character extender. It's only required for certain categories. You'll see it a lot in the injuries, your fracture coding, and those types of things, as well as some of your obstetric codes. That seventh character extender must always remain at that seventh character spot. It explains the status or the encounter, where the patient is in their healing process. Most often, unless you're in the fractures, you're going to see the same three status indicators or seventh character extenders. A for initial encounter, D for subsequent encounter, and S for sequelae. So keep in mind that seventh character extender has to stay in place for all codes that require that seventh character. But sometimes a code requires a seventh character extender and there aren't six characters in the code. So for those instances, ICD-10-CM uses what they call a dummy placeholder. It's used for those codes that require a seventh character extender that don't have six characters already. So for example, a patient is treated for the first time for a pathological fracture. You'll see M84.40XA for pathological fracture, unspecified site, initial encounter for a fracture. That X holds the spot. So our code for the pathological fracture unspecified site is actually M84.40, but I need that seventh character extender. So I've got to put that dummy placeholder, that literal X there, to hold the encounter place for me. So you're going to look up a code just like you did under ICD-9-CM. There's no big changes in the lookup process here. There might be some terms that you have to look up differently, but the actual process doesn't differ. You're going to start at the alphabetical index, and you're going to always confirm with the tabular list. You never ever code from the index, and this is extremely important under ICD-10-CM because of the laterality issues and the additional characters that are needed. So it's important for you to remember, start with your alphabetic index always, and then confirm with the tabular list. Abbreviation-wise, there's really nothing new here. We see all the same abbreviations that we're used to in ICD-9-CM. However, I want to point out a key difference between NEC and NOS. A lot of times when I'm out there working with people, they don't understand the difference between not elsewhere classifiable and not otherwise specified or unspecified, which leads to incorrect code assignment. So NEC means not elsewhere classifiable. And when you break that down, it means that you know what the patient's clinical condition is, but there's not a code there for it. So it's not elsewhere classifiable. Whereas for not otherwise specified or unspecified, it means that you're really not clear on the patient's clinical condition and the other codes have a specificity or a level that you're not ready to commit to yet. So it's unspecified. So you want to make sure that you use those so that you have the correct code assignment when you're working with your providers and make sure that they understand that key concept. So you're going to see some notes, instructional notes, just like we had under ICD-9-CM, your includes and your inclusion notes and those types of things. But we have a new concept under ICD-10 for exclusion notes, and that's excludes one and excludes two. And this can be a little bit confusing until you become more familiar with it. But basically, exclude one says never ever coded here. So the two clinical conditions cannot be coded together. A good example is that if a patient is being treated for gestational diabetes, they can't have both gestational diabetes and type 2 diabetes. It's clinically not possible. They have one condition or the other. So there's an excludes one note that says you can't code the two conditions together. The second is the excludes two note. The excludes two note says you can have both of the conditions together and they can be coded if both do exist. So we have an example here of an excludes two. You see where we have acute tonsillitis J03. There's an excludes two note for chronic tonsillitis, letting us know that if the patient has both acute and chronic tonsillitis, they can be coded together. Default codes are listed next to the main term in the alphabetical index. They supposedly represent the condition most commonly coded. However, what you're going to find represented is that it almost always refers to an unspecified code. You want to make sure that you never code directly from a default code. If you need to use it as a starting point or you're not quite sure, then go back and refer to it, but in the tabular list. But never code directly from the default code. Remember, I already told you that payers are going to start looking at those unspecified codes. So you want to make sure that you don't latch onto those under ICD-10-CM. Plus, keep in mind, under ICD-9-CM, a lot of times we had to use an unspecified code because there wasn't a better choice that was available to us. And now there is under ICD-10-CM. So we talked about laterality earlier and the fact that the right side is usually character 1, the left side is usually character 2, the bilateral code is usually character 3, and the unspecified side is either 0 or 9, depending on whether or not it's the 5th or 6th character. I use the word usually, not always. You will find where that concept is broken. So here we have an example of H02.854 for elephantiasis of the left upper eyelid. So you'll see that laterality concept broken when there's the upper or the lower lid in those types of situations. So normally you will see that the right side is character 1 or the left side is character 2. However, you can see in our example that that laterality concept is broken. So you need to keep that in mind as you begin to work with ICD-10-CM. So now we're going to go over some general coding guidelines that you need to really become familiar with so that you can begin to understand how these concepts interrelate so that their diagnosis codes can be coded to the highest level of specificity. One of the guidelines is that the diagnosis codes are to be used and reported at their highest number of characters available. So if there's a code that goes to the sixth character, you can't code it only with four characters. You have to take it to the sixth character. You have to take it to that highest level of specificity. Signs and symptom codes are acceptable for reporting when a related definitive diagnosis has not been established or confirmed by the provider. Signs and symptoms that are routinely associated with the disease process should not be assigned as additional codes unless you're instructed by the classification under ICD-10-CM. So keep in mind that if there's a condition that routinely has signs and symptoms, you're not going to code that if we have a confirmed or definitive diagnosis. So here's an example. We have a patient who presents to the office complaining of a cough, fever, and a sore throat. The physician examines the patient and diagnoses them with an upper respiratory infection. So you'll see under ICD-10-CM, we have the code J06.9 for the acute respiratory infection unspecified. We would not code the cough, fever, and sore throat additionally, as those are routine signs and symptoms of an upper respiratory infection. So we know that there are some conditions that require more than one diagnosis code to fully describe a single condition for the patient. You'll see instructional notes that indicate use additional code or code first. We have this concept still under ICD-9-CM. However, the instructional notes have greatly expanded under ICD-10-CM. So, for example, the patient presents to the office for a 3-month follow-up for his acute hepatitis A. He indicates to the physician that he's had an earache in the right ear for the last few days. And after the physician documents and examines the patient, he diagnoses it with otitis media as well as the hepatitis A. So in ICD-10-CM, we have B15.9 for the hepatitis A without hepatic coma and H67.1 for the otitis media and diseases classified elsewhere. Our tabular notes instruct our users to code first the underlying disease, such as viral disease not elsewhere classifiable, which is the range of B00 to B34, which is why we would code the B15.9 for the hepatitis A without hepatic coma first. So it's important to read and be led by those instructional notes in ICD-10-CM. For a patient that has both acute and chronic conditions, if they both exist, then you're going to sequence the acute condition first. For example, Jim suffers from acute and chronic maxillary sinusitis. So in ICD-10-CM, we have code J01.0 for the acute maxillary sinusitis unspecified and J32.0 for chronic maxillary sinusitis. So we talked briefly earlier about combination codes. The guidelines state that we need to assign only the combination code that fully identifies the diagnostic conditions involved or if the alphabetic index indicates or directs to it. Multiple coding should not be used if a combination code exists. So think of this as unbundling. You don't want to list the diagnoses each separately if there's one code that actually captures all of the conditions. In that case, you would only use the combination code. Here's an example. A physician diagnosed a patient with rheumatoid arthritis of the right ankle and foot who also has rheumatoid polyneuropathy. In ICD-10-CM, we needed two codes, one for the rheumatoid arthritis of the ankle and foot and one for the rheumatoid polyneuropathy. However, under ICD-10-CM, we have one code that captures the entire clinical condition, M05.571, for rheumatoid polyneuropathy with rheumatoid arthritis of the right ankle and foot. So you can see now where we have one code, which actually simplifies the number of codes that I need to put on my encounter. Late effects are the residual effect after the acute phase of an illness or injury has terminated. There's no time limit of when a condition can become a late effect or a sequela. It may appear early or months or years later. Late effect coding or sequelae coding generally requires two codes. The condition or the nature of the late effect is sequenced first, and the late effect code is sequenced second. For example, the patient suffers an oral hearing loss at 6 weeks after having meningitis. In ICD-10-CM, we have codes H90.5 for the unspecified sensory neural hearing loss and G09 for the sequelae of inflammatory diseases of the central nervous system. The guidelines go on to say that there's an exception for those instances where the code for the late effect is followed by a manifestation code that's identified in the tabular list in the title, or the late effect has been expanded to include the manifestations. Let's review an example on the next slide. So a patient attempted suicide by hanging himself 2 years ago. He was resuscitated in the ER but suffered anoxic brain damage. He presents to the office for a checkup on some new medication he's been recently prescribed. We have code G93.1 for the anoxic brain damage not elsewhere classifiable, and X83.8XXS for the intentional self-harm by other specified means sequelae. Here you can see we have the use of the dummy placeholders. The actual code for the intentional self-harm by other specified means is X83.8, but we need that seventh character extender to indicate the late effect or the sequelae, which is represented by the letter S. Sometimes we see a patient and they have an impending or threatened condition, and there's some guidelines that go along with those. So if the condition did occur, we're going to code it as confirmed. If it did not, we're going to look to the index for threatened or impending. And then we're going to code underlying conditions or signs and symptoms if we cannot find it there. So for example, in ICD-10-CM, there are codes for impending coronary syndrome, impending delirium tremens, and impending myocardial infarction. There are also codes for threatened abortion, threatened job loss, and threatened labor. But most often, if you can't find it under impending or threatened, then we're going to have to drop back and code the underlying conditions or the signs and symptoms that the patient sought out healthcare for. So it's important to understand that each unique ICD-10-CM code should only be reported once. Sometimes you'll find multiple conditions that are covered under one code, which means you would only use the code once. Even if the provider documented them out separately, one code will capture all of them. The exception is for those conditions that are bilateral that do not have a bilateral code choice selection. So you would need to use two codes then. And I use carpal tunnel syndrome as an example here. A lot of times we'll see patients present with bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. However, under ICD-10-CM, there's not a bilateral selection. So in this case, we would have to code once for the right side and once for the left side. So let's talk some more about our principal or our first listed diagnosis code. The guidelines tell us if no sequencing instructions apply, sequencing is based on the condition that brought the patient to seek their health care or the primary focus of the treatment. So if the patient presents for a routine annual physical, then the diagnosis that would be sequenced first would be for the preventive service. Additional guidelines actually include 1. A sign or symptom code is not to be used as a principal diagnosis when a definitive diagnosis for the sign and symptom has been established. That makes sense, right? 2. A sign or symptom code is to be used as a principal or first listed diagnosis code if there's no definitive diagnosis that's established at the time of coding. If the diagnosis is confirmed via testing prior to coding the encounter, the confirmed diagnosis should be reported. If anticipated treatment is not carried out due to unforeseen circumstances, the principal diagnosis first listed code remains the condition or the diagnosis that the provider planned to treat. 4. When the admission is for the treatment of a complication that results from surgery or other medical care, then your complication code is sequenced as the principal or the first listed diagnosis code. So those are our guidelines as they stand for principal or first listed diagnosis codes. Other than that, we need to be led by the instructional notes that you'll find within ICD-10-CM. I see this a lot where physicians include the diagnostic statement of resolved conditions or diagnosis as status posts from procedures from previous visits that have no bearing on the current treatment. If it was not addressed by the provider or the provider is not following the patient for that clinical condition, it should not be reported as codes. It's coded only if you have a policy exists that says it should be, which in most outpatient provider offices, these types of policies do not exist. So keep in mind, if the physician indicates that the condition is resolved or he did nothing to address or treat that clinical condition during that encounter, those should not be coded. For abnormal test findings, the guidelines tell us that they're not coded or reported unless the physician indicates the clinical significance. If the abnormal test finding corresponds to a confirmed diagnosis, it should not be coded in addition to the confirmed diagnosis. A sign or symptom code is used if there's no confirmed diagnosis. So if the physician documents, say, elevated lipids, unless he puts the significance of that or he clinically documents how that is affecting the patient's clinical condition, then it's not coded. So that's an important guideline to keep in mind. Just because he references an abnormal finding, we wouldn't code it unless he documents the significance of that abnormal finding. So in conclusion, don't be overwhelmed by the changes. You're going to see a lot of familiarities between ICD-9-CM and ICD-10-CM. ICD-10-CM is just greatly expanded. There's actually only about 8 new concepts found in ICD-10-CM that just weren't there under ICD-9. You will see some productivity issues as you begin to have to go back to the beginner experience and start looking everything up using the index, and some of the terms have changed, so that'll slow you down a little bit. The longer code descriptors will be a little bit difficult for you to maneuver right at the very beginning, but practice makes perfect. So if you use these key concepts and begin to work with their physicians on their clinical documentation piece, that's really going to help you solidify your transition into ICD-10-CM. It's going to keep you in compliance. It's going to make sure that you have your revenue stream. So it's going to be really important moving forward that you get your training at the right stages, that you don't learn the code sets too early before you start using them, so that you can actually be able to retain them as you're working with them. Keep in mind that practice will make perfect. You might want to do some dual coding for a while, where after you've learned ICD-10-CM, you start using both ICD-9 and ICD-10-CM to code encounters so that you can get your speed up and you become more familiar with those codes. Same with providers. You want to work with them on their clinical documentation and start with their most frequently used ones. You might have to go back in a few months and reinforce some of those and re-audit and make sure that they're still documenting those key concepts. Together, I know that we can make this transition. And I look forward to seeing you in part 3 of the Essentials for Providers.